invite you to listen to a story. It's actually labeled incorrectly in here. It's from the end of the Gospel of Luke, not the end of the Gospel of John. I apologize about that. But the Emmaus story. And listen to it as a story. Now, on that same day, two of them were going to a village. By the way, this is Easter Sunday, which you might think it ought to be a woohoo, Christ has risen kind of day. It's not. It is dark and it is filled with fear. The two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem, and talking with each other about all these things that had happened. While they were talking and discussing, Jesus himself came near and went with them, but their eyes were kept from recognizing him. And he said to them, "What are you discussing with each other while you are walking along?" And they stood still, looking sad. Then one of them, whose name was Cleopas, answered him, "Are you the only stranger in Jerusalem who does not know the things that have taken place in these days?" And he asked them, "What things?" And they replied, "The things about Jesus of Nazareth, who was a prophet, mighty in deed and word before God and all the people. And how our chief priests and leaders handed him over to be condemned to death and crucified him. But we had hoped." I want you to hear the sadness in those words. "But we had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. Yes, and besides all this, it is now the third day since these things took place. Moreover, some women in our group astounded us. They were at the tomb early this morning, and when they did not find his body there, they came back and told us that they had indeed seen a vision of angels and who said that he was alive. And some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but they did not see him." And then Jesus said to them, "Oh, how foolish you are and how slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have declared. Was it not necessary that the Messiah should suffer these things and then enter into glory?" And then, beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them the things about himself in all the scriptures. As they came near to the village to which they were going, he walked ahead of them as though he were going on, but they urged him strongly, saying, "Stay with us, because it is almost evening, and the day is now nearly over." So he went in to stay with them. When he was at table with them, he took bread, blessed and broke it, and gave it to them, and then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he vanished from their sight. They said to each other, "Were not our hearts burning within us while he was talking to us on the road, while he was opening the scriptures to us?" And that same hour, they got up and returned to Jerusalem, and they found the 11 and their companions gathered together, and they were saying, "The Lord has risen indeed and has appeared to Simon." And then they told all that had happened to them on the road and how he had been made known to them in the breaking of bread. Stories. One of the things about being an alleged grown-up is that I'm still having a hard time not having enough time to read books like I would like to. I mean, I read tons of articles. I read lots of commentary. I read perhaps too many editorials. But it is difficult to create the time to get completely immersed in the world of a book. A 21st century pace of life does not yield such luxurious time easily. Maybe that's why I like leading small groups. Because I can say, oh, I have to read this book because it's my job. It gives me permission to read deeply. I have to spend 6 hours reading this book because I have Monday Companions group and I have to. I'm not enjoying it or anything. It's just my job. I got to do it. It's my job as a pastor. I'm not having fun with this, I swear. I'm wondering if that might be the real reason I had kids, too. No, really, I have to read all 7 Harry Potter novels and all 7 Chronicles of Narnia out loud with lots of voices and really bad accents. It's my job as a parent. It's for their neurological development as children. I'm not enjoying these books at all. Really. So here's the thing about stories. The stories we are immersed in shape us deeply. For good or for ill, the narratives around us shape who we are. That's no secret. But there's an addendum to that that I read last month from Tom Brackett, who wrote, "The story we choose to tell will be the story we live into." Forgive the dangling preposition if you're a little rough on that. The story we choose to tell will be the story we live into. When Barb and I were baby pastors in the Northeast Kingdom, Barb had a parishioner named Jane who had an adopted African-American son named Adrian. And she had to choose what story to tell him about his adoption. And she'd been to a mother's support group, an adoptive mother's support group, and she heard a lot of stories about, oh, my kid, his mother, she was a junkie. His mother, she couldn't take care of him. His mother, they were too poor to have another kid. His mother, and she could have done that. She could have chosen to tell him, your mom, your birth mom didn't want you. Or your birth mom was a junkie. Or your birth mom was too poor to take care of you. But instead she told him, out of all the babies in the world, I found you and I chose you to be mine. She chose to tell that story, and both she and her son could live into that story. That he wasn't abandoned or given up, he was chosen, and he could live in the freedom of living into that story. My grandpa, my mom's dad, had a lot of stories. And it took me some time to discover which ones I would choose to live into. There were his anthropologist stories. He told stories about his research in Haiti in the 1940s, digging up prehistoric sites and finding definitive proof of the exact place where Columbus landed in 1492. He made Time magazine with his dashing mustachioed self. And it was very cool. This was pre-Indiana Jones, but that was what I had in my mind. But when I got to college, he started to tell me other stories of what it was like being a seminarian in Tübingen, Germany in 1932 and 1933, and trying to figure out how to live as a Christian in a newly minted fascist culture of Nazi Germany. It was his telling the story of his coming back to the United States, pastoring a Baptist church in Ohio, and getting fired for inviting black folk to worship there. Those became the stories I wanted to live into. And that's why he chose those stories to tell me. Now, this story from Luke about Cleopas and another person, his friend, his wife, we don't know. But these two disciples are walking along the road, making their way to Emmaus, a place of grief and escape, a place of waiting for the healing they know will not come after the horrific events of the past 3 days. They were possessed by a story. It's a well-known story, and it was a story they'd heard a million times. And the story goes like this: Empire wins. Evil wins. Good people get squished by the powerful. Threatening the status quo will get you killed. Fear wins out over love every time. Death is the last word. They knew that story. You know that story. And they were telling it over in their minds. They were living into it. Or perhaps more accurately, they were dying into it. But they said that they had heard a different story. They had heard the women's strange story of an empty tomb. But it didn't register. It couldn't register. The old story said death was it, man. They had heard Jesus' promises of rising. It didn't click. The old stories precluded such a thing. On the road, they even met Jesus, but their story kept them from recognizing him. Luke says they were kept from recognizing him. The King James translation is fabulous. It says, their eyes were holden that they should not know him. They couldn't recognize him because they were holding on to the old story. The saddest words we can say they uttered: we had hopes. We had hopes. But no longer. Last month during Lent, I shared about the thesis of a Christian sociologist named Paul Hebert, who talked about how communities and cultures can be either bounded or centered. Bounded communities have a wall around them, a wall of acceptable behavior, thought, appearance. It defines who the community is by the people who aren't in it. We, on the inside of the wall, are not like them on the outside of the wall. And a bounded community spends its energy on policing the norms within the community that keep people in or keep people out. In a centered community or a centered culture, instead of boundaries that define the people, it has something compelling at the center that pulls people in. A centered community is not defined by its boundaries, but by its center. So there are no gatekeepers. There are just people who are slowly being pulled ever closer toward the center. And as the people move toward the center, as they move closer to the center, they find that they are actually growing closer to one another. They also know that sometimes they seem farther out than at other times in their lives, and they can work on that. But that doesn't mean they're ever outside a defined boundary. They are still looking toward the center and defined by what is drawing them. They're defined by the heart of the community. Hebert gives the example of a ranch. Think of a huge spread in mid-19th century Texas. Now, if you have a really gigantic ranch, you can put a fence around it, but it'll be really expensive, and you can't make the cows pay for it. And a fence will break, and animals will escape. And a rancher who builds that will find that he's not so much a rancher anymore as he is a fence maintenance expert. So instead of building fences, he digs wells. And the animals would not stray too far from the wells because that is their source of life. That is a centered community. Where do we find life? Where do we find our source? And we're going to have that as our center, and we're going to stay focused on that, and we're not going to go wandering off somewhere else because it'd be crazy. Now, the unfortunate fact of human culture is that most communities and most cultures are bounded, including communities of faith. And one of the things that Hebert says is that the church is not meant to be a bounded community, but 99% of them are. We're Methodists because we're not Baptists, or we're not Catholic, or we're not anything else, right? Here's the acceptable behavior within and without that line. The church is meant, though, to be a centered community with Jesus Christ at the center. It's not rocket science. As Fred, I'm going to put you on the spot. Fred wrote on Facebook yesterday that there is no us and them in church. There should be no in or out thinking in God's kingdom. And Fred quoted Paul saying there is no Greek or Roman. There is no Greek or Jew. There is no slave or free. There is no male or female, for we all are one in Jesus Christ. Nobody is kept out because of their beliefs or their behaviors if their outlooks aren't perfect as defined by some norm. Everybody can be loved. Everyone can belong no matter what stage of brokenness or redemption they are in. But this is the thing. In order for a community of faith to be more than a rabble, and more than a social club, a church has to have something profound at its center, a source of spiritual gravity that holds it all together and pulls it all toward the center. Now, of course, that center for us is Jesus Christ, the crucified and risen one. But what does that mean? What does that look like in the real world? How do we see him? How does our portrait of him shape how we live and love? So over the next few weeks of the Easter season, we are going to be exploring what is at that center for us. When we see Jesus there, how does the rubber hit the road there? We're going to talk about shared beliefs and creeds. We're going to talk about shared values of justice and love. We're going to talk about shared actions of mercy and compassion. But today, to celebrate what's at the center, we have a story. What we have at the center is a story. A story of a broken humanity being made whole by a God who loved us so much as to become one of us. A God who loves us so much as to become vulnerable to human sin, to become fragile flesh for us and among us, to reconcile us and heal us and redeem us and make us whole. How many of y'all read or read the novel Life of Pi? It was, what, about a decade ago? Some of you see. Is that like a school assignment nowadays or no?
Oh. Just in one class.
Just in one class. It was also a movie, which I have not seen. The narrator is a wonderful guide to a number of different religious traditions, and he considers himself Hindu and Christian and Muslim. And he talks about the differences and what attracted him to all of them. And he marvels at the thousands of stories in Hinduism and how wonderful that is. But then he marvels at Christianity. He writes, their religion had one story. And to it, they came back again and again, over and over. It was story enough for them. I really like that. We have one story that we tell over and over and over again. And in every retelling, we find life. In every retelling, we find some new facet of beauty and truth. In every retelling of the story, when we choose to tell it, we live into it more deeply. We refind the center and head toward that. I'm going to sound like Garrison Keillor here. It was a rough week in Lake Wobegon, or in this case, it was a really rough week in the United Methodist Church. If you somehow missed it, if you missed the front page of the New York Times, our denomination has chosen to be a bounded community again. Bishop Olivito, who I know as a companion in faith, a student. When I was a student, I know her as an incredible disciple, as the most pastoral pastor I've ever met, and a true follower of Jesus Christ. That's how I know Bishop Olivito. In the news cycle, she's known as the first openly lesbian Bishop of the United Methodist Church. And that had someone from the South Central jurisdiction of our church make a complaint. It went to our version of the Supreme Court, and they came out with a statement that wasn't so good. The Judicial Council, which is our Supreme Court, said the most important thing, the story at our center, is to be bounded. The story at our center is not to go outside the walls that we've defined. The story at our center is to follow the rules. They're so afraid of a split in the church that they will not be open to the Spirit of God doing a new thing. Why would you choose to live in a negative story instead of a love story? Well, fear. Once you open yourself to a love story, you are no longer in control of the boundaries. Love's messy that way. Love is not neatly defined by borders. Once you open yourself to a love story, you lose control over the result. You become vulnerable to the movement of the Spirit, and it can feel like chaos if you're running the organization. It can feel like chaos if you're afraid of death. It's just like Cleopas and his companion. It's easier to live in a story of death, even when you know where it leads, than to have your eyes opened to a new story of love and life that you can only learn one step at a time, because that's terrifying, because I don't know where that ends. And I'm not so sure I can trust it. Now, there's a long arc of justice in the United Methodist Church. There is a long arc of love. We'll get there, but it may be too late. Because I don't know anyone under 40 who goes, I'm really looking for a church that defines who's in and who's out by their genitalia. Power of Emmaus the power of the story at the center the power of the story we choose to tell can be changed. That's what we learn at Emmaus. We don't have to follow a story of death. When we recognize Jesus in the midst of it, when our eyes are open to love, when our eyes are open to the presence of Christ in our midst, we can choose a new story of life and love. We can choose a redemption story. We can choose a story centered on love and freedom rather than bounded rules of fear and death. Jesus meets these two on the road, offering them a new story that they can't see. But Jesus loves them too much to leave them blind. He walks with them, he speaks with them, he shares with them until in bread broken, their eyes are opened. The old story is forgotten. They hear the story and become Easter people, resurrection people. They are now, as Paul writes, new creations in him, creatures of hope and life and love, because the experience of the resurrected Jesus, the story of God's love enfleshed, is now at the center of their being, and nothing will ever be the same. The Emmaus story tells us that when we experience Jesus Christ ourselves, face to face, on the road of real life, our eyes are opened and our stories are changed. I know you've got the scripts in your head that might have been written for you by your parents, might have been written for you by a really toxic boyfriend or girlfriend, or a really damaging marriage. Meeting Christ on the road says that script can be tossed. You can throw it away. You can find love at the center. You can learn that you are an infinitely valuable and beloved child of God. And nothing else matters. The amazing promise is that Jesus does meet us on the road. In our real lives, Jesus meets us on the road, inviting us to recognize him and be changed and transformed and made new. Now, how we meet him is different for every one of us. We don't have a bounded way of experiencing Jesus as our center. Thanks be to God. Maybe you experience Jesus most powerfully in quiet times of prayer, or in studying creeds or reading theology. Maybe your eyes are opened when you serve Jesus in concrete acts of love and service and mercy and compassion. Maybe it's being out in nature where you realize the reality of the resurrection in the song of peepers and the budding of leaves. Maybe it's in worship. Maybe it's in gathering together to offer up our whole selves to Christ, heart, soul, mind, and strength. Maybe it's in songs sung or prayers shared or scripture read or ritual relived, in wine poured and bread broken. However you meet Christ, it is the story at our center, the one we choose to tell, and the one we get to live into.